Foyer, foyer, foyer. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-1108. Morelli Armstrong Tire Corporation, retiring medical management trust, definitively on behalf of Federal National Mortgage Association and Wayne County Employee Retirement System, definitively on behalf of Federal National Mortgage Association appellant, Mrs. Frances D. Rain L., Mr. Barron for the appellant, Mr. Mahoney for the appellate.
May it please the court, Randall Barron for appellant. We would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if we may, Your Honor.
You may. Morning.
$6 billion was restated at Fannie Mae for the misconduct that the corporate directors and officers undertook during the relevant time period. An army of lawyers, accountants, and consultants had to be brought in order to not only cure the problems, but to figure out what those problems were and put the ship right. Over $1 billion was spent in order to try to right the ship of what those faithless fiduciaries did. $245 million of undeserved incentive compensation was paid to the executives of Fannie Mae based upon financial statements that were wrong. 40% of the earnings that the company earned evaporated from the relevant time period as a result of the misconduct. $400 million was paid to the SEC and OFAO for fines that the regulators imposed on the company. Not money to the company, Your Honors, but money that the company had to pay to regulators. And nobody at that company has done anything to go back after those faithless fiduciaries in order to get even a portion of that money back, or in order to get the insurance money that the company paid year.
You seem to be talking about the accountants and maybe the officers, but we're here to talk about the directors and the standards under Delaware law for director liability, which are quite high. You might want to address that.
We are, Your Honor. And the reason that we are is that, first, Mr. Franklin Rains was a director, chairman of the board, CEO of the company. Howard was a director.
The other directors.
Mudd was a director.
We're here to talk about the other directors.
But we're not, because those directors also have to fit into the mix. In order to determine demand futility, you have to determine that half or more of the board was knowledgeable. There is no question that those three executives were knowledgeable of it. There is also no question that the rest of the board, or at least the audit committee, was well aware of that. What the standard that we have to look at in a context like this came from the Supreme Court in Delaware, in Aronson. But what the Supreme Court said is that the machinery of corporate democracy and the derivative suit are potent tools to redress the conduct of the torpid and unfaithful management, meaning that when the directors themselves do not undertake it upon themselves to go after those people, and they haven't after 4 years of this lawsuit, then the shareholders can. And the standards are different under different types of claims. Two I'd like to focus on, if I could.
Before you get into those two, I have just a question or two about our jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
1723.
Yes.
If I were looking at that language afresh, I would read in any court of competent jurisdiction as requiring an independent source of jurisdiction.
And I think that, the language that you're looking at in that section of the sue or be sued, I think is virtually identical, different words, but talks again about in the American Red Cross, and I think it also talks of courts of competent jurisdiction.
The language is actually different.
Well, I think, and word choice, but I think the concept, and when you're talking about in-state or federal court, I believe that the analysis is we're talking about you can't sue in bankruptcy court, it can't be in family law court. I think competent jurisdiction is a court that is competent to hear the type of matter before it and not whether it's in state or federal, because those words, state or federal, are in the statute themselves. I think in this case,
court of competent jurisdiction doesn't have any meaning under your view, does it?
I think it absolutely does. I think that what you're trying to assure is that you are not bringing a lawsuit like this in the bankruptcy court, or you're not bringing the lawsuit in the family law court, or you're not bringing it in the court that act, just because it says you can bring it in state and federal does not open up the panoply of all the various courts under both state and federal law. And I think that is the way that I would read it, which is you're talking about state and federal courts overall. And then within those state and federal courts, you still have to have competent jurisdiction. It doesn't confer jurisdiction on every single court within both the state and federal system. And I think in this case, we're really talking belt and suspenders, because I think you do have other jurisdiction both on diversity grounds, and you have, and we, as we briefed in our supplemental briefing, we also think that it is original jurisdiction under the Act as well.
Is there any case that you can cite where this kind of sue and be sued clause, which has that language, courts of competent jurisdiction, which modifies the phrase federal court, where that was held to be jurisdictional?
I still believe that the best case for that is American Red Cross, but it doesn't have that.
It doesn't
exactly
have that language.
I agree with the court, and I don't believe so. I think that the appellees submitted a supplemental brief that talked about the competent jurisdiction, and I don't know that case as well as they do, Your Honor. Back, if I may, to answer Judge Kavanaugh's question. In this case, I think there's two primary theories that I want to focus on, although I think we've said in our complaint a number of ways that you're going to get to a majority of the board, both on independence grounds and unreasonable exercise of business judgment. But the two ways I'm talking about is whether they are aware of the county improprieties or the compensation benefits given to Mr. Raines and Howard as they were kicked out the door. With regard to the first, the Delaware Supreme Court case of Stone v. Ritter made clear that all plaintiffs need to allege is that the directors knew that they were not discharging their fiduciary obligations.
Knew. That's the key word there. Knew.
It is. But that's not an issue. And that's where the district court below, I think, erred. There is no question, and the opinion itself doesn't say that they didn't know.
You know, you said the district court erred. You know, I mean, our standard review is abuse of discretion. So you need to convince the court that the district court's decision, its consideration of these red flags and its rejection of them, was an abuse of discretion.
And we did brief that, I do believe that this should be like any other pleadings motion. I think that most of the circuit courts that have looked at demand futility, Delaware Supreme Court clearly looks at it, that it is looked at like any other 12B6 motion in which it is de novo. But I do understand there's precedent.
You understand our precedent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you do have to make your case on the abuse of discretion standard.
I understand. And I think we have. And the way I think we have is because, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out, the question is not do they know. And what we did plead and what the district court accepted was that the board or the audit committee was expressly told in August of 2003 that Mr. Barnes had put together a memorandum that detailed numerous instances of financial fraud.
Weren't they then assured by internal legal and financial officials that KPMG had looked into this and there was not a problem?
Well, that's
in other words, the red flag turned into a yellow or green flag as a result of the internal assurances. It's not like they got the memo and just said, forget about it. You're not alleging that.
Right? That's actually what we did allege. In fact, what we did allege, and we got books and records, and we alleged that in that board meeting that they were told of that. And the two people that they relied upon was Ms. Spencer and Mr. Rajapa. Mr. Rajapa was the theoretical independent auditor. Mr. Rajapa reported directly to Mr. Howard, and we plead that. Mr. Rajapa was a former employee in the control division. Ms. Spencer was the head of the controlling division. We plead that the head of the audit committee, Mr. Garrity, knew that Mr. Rajapa, or didn't know how Mr. Rajapa got the position. We feel that Mr. Rajapa did not know what gap accounting was. Mr. Rajapa wasn't qualified. So you can't simply accept that they knew something and therefore they discounted it as a basis to say that they didn't know under Stone v. Ritter. And I think that's really the key here. In fact, if you take it down that path, then you really flip it over on its head. Because that means the more you actually tell a board member, and if they hear it, and there's somebody in the room that says, we don't agree with it, then they are less liable than they are in cases like Sendent, Oxford, Abbott Labs, McCall, in which those directors were not told directly that there was a problem. Those directors were in a position where the court said they really should have known because the information was
closed. Directors told all the time that there are problems, and then they hear from the people who are responsible for dealing with those problems, experts. I mean, it's not a board of accountants, it's a board of directors, right?
Yeah, but you've set up, Your Honor, a situation in which they can never be liable because they always have in the room with them people from management and their accountant in the room with them. The question is, and it's a question of fact for the trier of fact, whether or not the reliance on those experts is appropriate, whether or not they undertook the independent analysis, because even the Delaware Supreme Court says, and the affirmative says that you have to rely on your experts, you have to studiously make sure you know all the facts, understand the facts, and take those actions necessary. Rule 141E, which is the ability to rely, which is in Delaware law, and I'm out of time, so let me just finish this answer. Rule 141E says it's an affirmative defense. So they have to prove not only that they actually relied on their experts, but that they had a basis to rely on those experts.
You cited the Seventh Circuit's Abbott Labs case?
Yes, Your Honor.
But weren't the red flags there a lot more obvious than here?
I think they were substantially less obvious,
Your Honor.
There were
6 years of noncompliance, many FDA inspections and noncompliance, Wall Street Journal article.
And no evidence that any of that went to the board members other than CEO and chairman. All of those warning letters went to the CEO and chairman. You can't prove that the board of directors read the newspapers. You can't prove that they didn't allege the board of directors knew about any of the investigation. What they said was, because the corporation theoretically had internal controls, we assume all of that information was shared with the rest of the board. There was no actual information that went to the board of directors in Abbott Labs or McCall.
Let me ask you a question about the allegations in the complaint about the Fannie Mae Foundation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The complaint alleges contributions to organizations affiliated with, I think, six directors, right?
Yes.
Are you alleging that all six of them, because of that, have lost their independence, don't have independence?
Yes, we are alleging that. We are alleging that there is a financial motivation for them or a social relationship.
Does any contribution of any kind trigger that consequence, or does it have to be of a certain size and of a certain kind?
I think that, like anything else in a complaint, it is a totality of the circumstances situation.
Because
if you look at the amount of money and the way that the Fannie Mae Foundation overall was being used, which was as a method to manage their earnings and keep those earnings flat, I think in this context, yes, any amount is a reasonable amount to show lack of independence. I think in another situation where the foundation doesn't have such a relationship with the financial accounting and the propriety of that corporation, then I think that you're going to say, well, you know, a $50 contribution to the Boy Scouts and the director happens to be a Boy Scout leader, I would agree with the court that that's not so. I think the numbers that we put in are talking in the hundreds of thousands or the millions, so I think that those numbers are sufficient, but no, the answer to the question is not in every situation.
One last question. You you challenged the district court's reliance on the Rudman report?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defendants in their brief say that the citation to it was harmless error. And you didn't respond to that in your reply brief. They say it was just additive.
Well, I don't agree
you,
that...
You didn't respond to that. I'm curious about what your
answer is. I think our position with regard to citations to the Rudman report, the 8K, et cetera, was that these were used by the court for his basis, not that they didn't know, but that their response thereto was, in his mind, as a trier of fact, was sufficient. And I believe that using the Rudman report, because that was really the Rudman report's conclusion, which was, you know, Mr. Rudman, with his background, he was still working for a law firm hired by the board to do an investigation, and they liked his conclusion. And that was what he relied upon in that.
Okay. Thank you.
I apparently used up all my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to turn first to the issue of the scale of the liability and whether that can give rise to an inference.
I just want to ask you one jurisdictional question.
Certainly.
I think you cited in your brief the Supreme Court's decision in what is this case? Breuer, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
You cited that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you read these two sentences from Breuer? It says, the court first says that the case could have been brought under that statute, but then it says, and district court would in any event have had jurisdiction under 1331. Doesn't that suggest that the first sentence maybe isn't that dispositive?
I think you're right, Your Honor. It's not the key cases we're relying on, because what we're really talking about are the rules of interpretation that are used in federal charter cases. Red Cross, of course, is a federal charter case, and it adopts the rule that when a federal charter uses a specific reference to federal courts in a sue and be sued clause, that it should be construed to create federal jurisdiction. And
the Red Cross statute didn't have the language courts of competent jurisdiction.
It did not, Your Honor. It said courts of law and equity, and this one says courts of competent jurisdiction. But there's really no reason to think that Congress intended a different result, because at the time that language was in there, it was the same language that was in Section 1702, and the Fourth Circuit in the Ferguson case had actually construed that language to create federal jurisdiction, because it was a sue-and-be-sued clause that specifically referenced federal courts, and it's not in any sense superfluous, because it would serve two functions, I think. First of all, it would demonstrate that the court would have to have personal jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court in the Blackmar case, just a few years before Congress adopted this language in 1954, had in fact construed courts of competent jurisdiction to be a reference to courts with personal jurisdiction. And second, I think that it is also the case that it could be a reference to make clear that Congress wasn't trying to create jurisdiction in bankruptcy courts for Fannie Mae to sue solvent parties on trademark claims. So it still has some work to do. It's not completely superfluous. I'd also note that the policies at issue in Red Cross are completely applicable here. Fannie Mae is a federally chartered corporation with a public mission, just as the Red Cross was. And the Solicitor General appeared in the Red Cross case as an amicus to say that it would further the policies of the United States to recognize federal jurisdiction. And similarly, Your Honor, they took the position it was just a brief in opposition, but the Solicitor General also took the position that the same language under Section 1702 should be read as conferring federal jurisdiction for federally chartered corporations in a case called Portsmouth Development. So I think that there are ample reasons why the rationale of Red Cross should apply here, and that there's just no reason to infer that Congress in 1954, when it put this language in, was trying to strip Fannie Mae of the right to go to federal court or be sued in federal court. In fact, it was still a federal agency at the time. So, and also, Your Honor, it really isn't necessary to jurisdiction. There's certainly federal question jurisdiction in this case. It just has to be a non-frivolous federal claim. So it would not be essential for this court to reach the issue by any means. And I would just add that the recent, the more recent Section 1702 cases that were cited by some of the district courts have almost no reasoning in them, and they were all before Red Cross. So I don't, and they also, except for one, it wasn't even an issue that was important to the resolution of whether they had jurisdiction. I think all signs, even though I understand why the court textually, when you first look at it, it's not the most obvious reading we would come up with, but it wasn't in Red Cross either. And yet the court, you know, said that this has a long history where Congress acted against the backdrop of a rule that said sue and be sued clauses for federally chartered companies, when they referenced federal courts specifically, ought to be read as a grant of jurisdiction, and there was nothing to question that reading at the time Congress adopted this language. If I could, if I could turn to the issue of Caremark liability for the accounting claims, of course the plaintiffs don't deny that they have to establish a very high standard under Delaware law in order to excuse demand, and that is that there is a substantial likelihood that the plaintiffs would ultimately prevail on a claim that the directors acted in bad faith. This is a bad faith claim, and to give rise to that inference is rather extraordinary, and I think it bears emphasis that under Delaware law, under Section 141E, by statute, Delaware has provided that directors, quote, shall be fully protected, end quote, for relying on information, reports, and statements by any experts from the company, employees of the company, or outside experts. And the Delaware courts have used this to say that plaintiffs have a heavy burden, even in the demand futility context, to come forward when there are allegations of expert assurances of legality, to come forward with very particularized allegations that would show why it would be in bad faith to have relied on those experts. Plaintiff's own complaint in paragraph 171 confirms that KPMG gave unqualified opinions of gap compliance, of compliance every year at issue here.
Well, the FAO report's pretty tough, though, on the board. It says it abandoned its checks and balances oversight responsibilities, did not adopt and impose policies requiring that critical accounting policies and transactions be vetted, allowed management to determine with little opposition the information it received, missed many opportunities for meaningful oversight. And there's a lot in there that's not a pretty picture.
But nothing, Your Honor, to suggest there was bad faith. In fact, the language, if you look at the summary of the board findings in the FAO final report at A444, the language speaks in terms of lack of adequate attention. A729, lack of appropriate vigor. No suggestion that we're talking here about bad faith. This is not a due care claim. There can't be a failure to exercise due care here. It actually has to go to the level of a violation of the duty of loyalty and the duty of good faith. And there are, I think, two pages of the FAO report which are incorporated by reference just destroy the plaintiff's claim. If I could read to you from one of them is page A714, which deals with the Barnes allegations. That's the whistleblower. It says that the general counsel told the committee, quote, the allegations were without merit, that KPMG had fully reviewed the allegations, and that Mr. Barnes had expressed satisfaction that his concerns had been addressed, end quote. These statements, quote, undoubtedly had the effect of misleading the audit committee. That's with respect to Barnes. And then if you look at A671, it says that KPMG performed detailed reviews of FAS 91 and FAS 133 and gave assurances that the company was in compliance, and it says the board relied on these assurances and failed to detect the accounting deficiencies, to the same effect at A694. The plaintiffs do not cite a single case where a court has excused demand for a Caremark claim when there are allegations that the board members were relying on experts, not one. The cases they cite all involve situations where the courts inferred or had actually direct allegations that the board was aware of particular violations, was not assured that the company was in compliance and nevertheless did nothing. Here, as the district court carefully found, the complaint itself shows that the board was listening, was asking questions, was given assurances. And under Delaware law, they shall be fully protected under those circumstances.
The Sixth Circuit case in McCall is consistent with Delaware law?
Your Honor, I think that it was before Stone versus Ritter. I doubt that the Delaware courts would have resolved it the same way. But there are a couple things about McCall that I think are important. One is that it wasn't about gap violations. It was about fraud. It was about committing health care fraud, and there was no allegation they were relying on, that they were getting reassurances from the experts that the policies of the company were in compliance. And instead, what they said is that they were given audit reports where they could see that there were secret cost reserves, that they were the secret reports that they were not giving to the government, and they were accounting for costs in different ways. That's the way that the court evaluated the evidence there. So here, so what they found was that it was unmistakable notice of violations. Here we're talking about gap violations. Gap is a very, very complex set of rules to apply. Courts have repeatedly found it is an art. It's not a science. In fact, if we want to look at whether these were obvious violations, there's just a few points here. One is KPMG was signing off every year, as the plaintiffs have alleged. In addition, Ofeo conducted annual reviews of the safety and soundness, and in 2002 reported to Congress that it had looked at FAS 133 issues and it didn't find a problem. And so that shows that it is not so obvious. And at page A552 of the Ofeo final report, it acknowledges that earnings management can be proper. So, in other words, this is not the kind of violation that you can say, obviously, despite the assurances of KPMG, despite the assurances of management, that the board members would have known that they couldn't rely on these outside experts and that instead they would have known that there were problems with the accounting. It's simply not black and white in the way that it would have to be. The cases I think that are most analogous in that regard are Ash versus McCall and Caremark itself, where in both of those cases the Delaware courts refused to find liability under Caremark or to excuse demand under Caremark because the board members had been assured by experts that the policies were in compliance. And Caremark says that the liability at issue there, this was a health care fraud case as well, and the court said that the liability was huge. That's their term, that the scale of the liability was not the test, and it was criminal liability. But they said that the board members had been reassured by their experts that even though there were some questions about compliance, that they thought that they were in compliance with the law, and that was enough. Absent, you know, something, you know, much more compelling that would allow an inference that they simply knew that this was all just a sham and in bad faith decided to do nothing. We have really, you know, no allegations of that type here. With respect to the issue of the compensation claims, which plaintiffs, I think, put less reliance on, but I think it is important to emphasize a couple of facts. First of all, this also requires a showing that the board members acted in bad faith when they decided to allow Raines and Howard to retire and resign, as opposed to terminating them for cause. I think their reply brief shows that that's really the nature of the claim that they're pursuing at this point, and not something related to the approval of the termination agreements at the outset. And with respect to that, this is a classic kind of business judgment. It's the kind that Brehm and Aronson, were both compensation-related decisions, say that the board gets, you know, particularly broad deference on, and that they would have to show that there was no conceivable valid purpose for this decision, and that it is so irrational that you could infer bad faith, conscious disregard of their duties and bad faith. And here it seems, you know, quite, first of all, as a matter of pleading, they haven't even given us the tools to analyze whether this was so irrational as to be in bad faith, because they haven't alleged what the terms were of the agreements as to, you know, when they could terminate for cause, or what items of compensation that were paid out at the end would be proper under that termination clause or not.
What about their allegations about the contributions to the Fannie Mae Foundation?
Well, Your Honor,
not related to this? Don't they claim that shows lack of independence?
Yes, they did. I had read their briefs to barely rely on it, and I think that's because the district court found that they should be rejected on a couple of grounds. The first is that under Delaware law, you have to show that the interested director actually controlled the ability to direct, had unilateral control over directing that.
At this stage, this is, we're at the pleading stage here.
That's correct.
We have to accept their facts as true. We have to give all inferences in plaintiff's favor, right? And they don't have to prove lack of independence at this time. All they have to show is a reasonable basis for it.
Well, they have to show yes, Your Honor, but they can't use conclusory allegations.
Well, they haven't. They've got like 20 pages of facts about each of these directors and the substantial contributions given to by Fannie Mae to organizations they're affiliated with.
Well, and they also have to
get the pleading stage.
Yes, we are, Your Honor. And those kinds of claims have been rejected in Delaware because they do require heightened pleading, particularized pleading.
That's the question. Why doesn't this meet that standard? It goes on for, I don't know what more they could have at this stage.
Well,
given the number of grants, the amount of the grants, the relationship of the grants to the size, and again, the question is granting inferences in their favor. Right?
Your Honor, there's a couple things about this. First of all, I would say that Alfeo's report at A763, which is incorporated by reference, specifically says that Fannie Mae's foundation grants they adhered to the New York Stock Exchange standards of independence in all material respects. So that's part of the allegations here, and the Delaware courts have said that compliance with those standards is a good indication that that you don't have an independence problem. In addition, if you look at
is there an allegation in the complaint that they changed the corporation's ethical standards in order to ensure some of these would retroactively be okay?
Your Honor, they actually changed the standards to tighten them up prospectively, but that's just because they went to stricter standards than what are required, certainly than what's required by Delaware law, but also than what's required by some of the other model standards. In addition, Your Honor,
the key answer to my question then is that they complied with New York Stock Exchange standards.
In addition, Your Honor, it's more than that. That is certainly a reason why they can't show particularized pleadings that there's an independence problem. But also, if you look at the district court found they didn't establish that they didn't have allegations to show the materiality to enough of the directors. And in particular, the big...
They need four, right?
Well, they need four. That's correct. And for instance, with Garrity, they talk about foundation contributions to Wharton School between $10,000 and $25,000.
But they've got much more current data and much larger data for Duberstein, Malik, Swigert, and Core Logos.
Well, except that if you look at the time period, Your Honor, the numbers, Howard University, I believe, was $450,000 since 1996.
Right.
Over a long period of time, amounts accumulate.
The pleading stage.
Yes.
Right. Is this a granting all inferences in their favor?
Yes. Granting all inferences in their favor under the Delaware cases that have found even bigger contributions to be, as in Disney, to be not material for this purpose. You can't infer that these size of contributions would be sufficient to say that these individuals lacked independence, especially since the district court also recognized that they didn't establish that Raines controlled these contributions. In other words, they didn't establish that Raines had the ability to ensure that these contributions went to these individuals. And under Delaware law, they had to demonstrate that Raines had unilateral control over who got this money. And as the district court properly found, the complaint just does not allege facts from which you could reasonably draw that inference.
So speaking of pleading stage, does it make sense to have abuse of discretion review of something like this?
Well,
other than the fact that there's a case that says it, but if you were starting that anew, I'm not sure what sense that makes.
I think it does actually make sense, Your Honor. And here's what I would I think if you look at the advisory committee notes under 23.1, this is an issue about who ought to be able to bring this action, whether they can bring this action. It's the corporation's claim, who's an adequate representative, and then whether demand has been excused.
But when you peel that back, it's ultimately whether the directors, whether they've pleaded enough to hold the directors liable under Delaware law, and usually we review something like that de novo.
Well, except it's really an issue. It's sort of like there are many cases, like Rule 11, for instance, where the issue under Rule 11 can be whether the legal contentions are warranted by existing law. That's a legal question, but it's nevertheless viewed as one of the questions that's part of the supervisory powers of the district court over litigation. And the Supreme Court held in Cooter and Gale v. Hart Marks that was, even though these are legal issues, legal in character, they nevertheless are all subject to abuse of discretion standard of review. The same thing happens in the class action context under Rule 23. Some of those issues, like typicality, may well be issues that are largely just determined by looking at the particular facts and saying, okay, under the legal standards, what's the right answer here? Not, and nevertheless, those are subjected to abuse of...
Let's go back. Let me just pursue Judge Kavanaugh's question in the context of the foundation issue. I mean, I'm not at all sure how to think about the abuse of discretion there, other than, I guess, for example, would it be an abuse of discretion if he didn't grant all inferences in plaintiff's favor? Yes, right?
It can be.
But that would be the same as de novo review.
Well, oftentimes, under an abuse of discretion standard, courts find that there has been an error because, for instance, if he applied the wrong legal standards, then under an abuse of discretion...
De novo review would produce the same result.
In some circumstances, it would. But here, I think the answer is that if you look at what this court said in Galbert is that it's a narrow standard and that you look to see did he make a clear error of law? Did he?
We don't have to actually figure that out, do we?
Because you're bound? Because you're bound?
To figure out what that means.
But, yes, but I do think that it is an appropriate allocation of responsibility between the district courts and the Court of Appeals for this kind of issue.
I want to take you back to just for a minute, if I could, to the compensation questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court found no bad faith or lack of information, and he relied on the fact that compensation for Fannie Mae officers is constrained by law and reported to Congress, that they relied on compensation consultants, right? That they're submitted to OFIO. And what does all that have to do with the retirement question?
I think it has very little to do with the retirement question.
So but the district court relied.
But could I be clear? I think the district court was responding to a claim that the plaintiffs aren't advancing on appeal. The plaintiffs' complaint, and as the district court clearly read it, was making two claims. The first, that the directors had breached their duties by approving these, not just the termination package in the end, but rather the agreements themselves. And so much of his analysis is directed at that very question. In other words, could you find a breach of duty by virtue of the decision to adopt these particular contracts in the first place? And so his analysis is completely relevant to that, which is to say, wait a minute.
How do we sustain his decision on the decision to allow them to retire?
Well, I think he goes beyond there and says that there are no allegations to indicate that this is bad faith to have made this decision. And I think if the court just looks at the Brehm decision of the Delaware Supreme Court, the final Disney decision, and the Supreme Court's decision in White versus Panic.
Can we just look at the way the district court dealt with Disney?
Well, he certainly deals with Disney correctly, and the other Supreme Court cases from Delaware on this issue also show essentially you'd have to, in order to infer bad faith, you'd have to find that it would be completely irrational for the board to enter to decide to allow voluntary resignation under these circumstances, looking at things like the prospect for contentious litigation, whether they might in fact end up owing damages as a result of it. Those are the kinds of issues.
Okay. We've taken it well over time.
I'm sorry, I had one additional question on the jurisdictional issue. You said, after talking about the sue and be sued clause, that we have, in any event, subject matter jurisdiction, but you didn't elaborate on that.
So I
just wondered what the basis.
Sure. I think that under Section 1331, certainly for federal question jurisdiction, because the complaint has now been amended to, the motion was granted to allow that amendment, and the plaintiff's theory is that that there is a claim that arises under, it would be under
the. It looks like a state claim.
Well, when you read the complaint, it doesn't. I think, you know, they may have pled it in the alternative, but it has been amended to assert a federal claim, and I don't think that's. I mean, the test under Bell versus Hood is just whether or not that's frivolous, and there is, of course, under 12 CFR section 1710.10, Fannie Mae has adopted Delaware corporate governance procedures and policies. To govern their conduct to the extent it isn't inconsistent with the FAO standards.
It's not clear how you could get Delaware law into this case otherwise, right?
But it does. Delaware law is in this case.
No, I know,
yes.
Only because of the federal.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. But
otherwise,
so,
you wouldn't be able to do it under Delaware law.
But I think they have a non-frivolous claim that they have a derivative action by virtue of that section that has adopted Delaware law.
Thank you. We took you well over here.
Thank you.
Does council have any remaining comments?
Council has 15 seconds.
Well, you can take it.
You can take 5 minutes.
You can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We used up a lot of your time.
Let me briefly address the jurisdiction. I'd like to move on because I think there's other ones I'd like to spend time on. On the jurisdiction, two other points we could make, which is we've also brought Section 304 clawback under Sarbanes-Oxley, which I think does in and of itself provide for federal subject matter jurisdiction.
Is there a private right of action under that?
Well, I think there are some district courts that have said no. There's been no circuit court who has ruled on that yet. It meets the factors of Court v. Ash, but I think, but as far as just jurisdiction, we have pled at least a good faith claim of federal jurisdiction. Also, one of the court's points of they just adopted Delaware law. Remember, they could have adopted the Model Penal Act or Model Code. So if that were the case, then pulled into federal law would have been no state law whatsoever, would have just been this treatise of corporate law. So I think that would, had they done that, we would have even been more clear that we're applying federal law. I think counsel missed.
I mean, that was meant to be a helpful question on the jurisdictional point.
Yeah.
In other words, you.
No, I was confirming that you were correct because
otherwise we would, you know, Delaware law would have nothing to do with this, but for the fact that federal law incorporates Delaware law. Right?
Exactly, and I was pointing out that with the Model Penal Act, it's even more obvious that it could not be a state law. Or model code. A couple of things I do want to point out. I think counsel misspoke when she said that we have to plead a substantial likelihood of prevailing on this claim. Rails, the Delaware Supreme Court, expressly held, we reject defendant's proposal that the purpose of this derivative suit and future similar suits, we adopt either a universal demand requirement, meaning they have to demand no matter what, or a requirement that plaintiff must demonstrate a reasonable probability of success on the merits. So the Delaware Supreme Court made very clear that
substantial likelihood is the test.
The test under Stone v. Ritter is whether or not
that gets into the secondary, but the initial question for the demand is substantial likelihood, and then you go in to look at what the standards for director liability are. And then Stone v. Ritter sets up the knowledge standard.
Well, it's whether we plead with particularity a reasonable doubt that the Board of Directors could have properly exercised its independent and disinterested business judgment in responding to a demand. It's not with a likelihood of success. I disagree with that. I think it's particularity as to a reasonable doubt. And I think that's when we get back to the court's question. We still have to draw all inferences in favor of plaintiffs, and we still have to look at the complaint as pled and not go outside the complaint. I also want to point out when counsel says that there's no case in which the court adopted where they adopted a position that it was fine if they received expert advice, that's because defendants don't cite a single case in which the court found that the board had actual direct knowledge of the misconduct and considered it. There is no case in there. In fact, if you look at Ashby Court and Caremark, the standards in both, and in Caremark in particular, the court said that what they were looking at is whether or the claim asserted was that directors ought to have known of it, and if they had known, they would have been under a duty to bring some sort of an action.
I think you're jumping ahead, though, because you've said knew of actual misconduct, but that's the question. A question's raised to the board, right? And then they have to figure out whether it's actual misconduct or not. And as the allegations go, then they receive advice from people internal and external, from KPMG and from internal people, to determine whether it's misconduct. So you said they knew it was misconduct. I think that's playing a little loose with what the allegations are.
See, I think it's the other way around, Your Honor, because we know it was misconduct. Nobody questions that Mr. Barnes was cited over 200 times in the OFAO report. What he said, his work was accurate. They were, in fact, defrauding investors through their financial statement.
But wasn't the board misled? Not by Barnes, but by the others who assured the board that the Barnes issues were taken care of? Your allegations?
That's a trial fact. That's the point.
Under your allegations, though.
Under our allegations, no, because we said that they were covered up. We said because of the relationships, the disinterested, everything else, that they covered up. And the only thing that they did, and remember, we had a books and record request. We have the board minutes. We have the board minutes of that August meeting. And all they did is they were told about Mr. Barnes's thing, and they said, and it's fine, trust us. And the question then becomes under 141E.
And it's fine, trust us was stated by people with responsibility for knowing something about that.
Well, it was stated by the person who was in charge of the controller, Ms. Spencer, not somebody independent, and Mr. Rajapa, which they didn't have any independent line of communication with them. What the board should do, and
that goes to maybe they should have asked for more, but it doesn't really go to that they knew.
But then that's every situation. Then you've now created the exception that swallows the rule, because until the board is proved to them absolutely that it's true, then they don't know. And
well,
if you look
no,
at all...
To take these facts and vary them, if the Barnes memo comes in to the board and they just say, toss it in the outbox, then you have a claim. That's not what you're alleging here.
I allege that that's virtually what they did. I allege that they had... One meeting, one comment was made. They were told about that, the Barnes memo. They weren't told, perhaps, or they were, about how hard Mr. Barnes worked to try to get it, that Mr. Barnes had provided a separate memo to Mr. Raines before, that he had talked to his supervisors and his supervisor's supervisors, and that he'd been fighting. We also allege the cover-up, which is that Mr. Barnes was excluded from the OFAO investigation. We also allege that they knew already in the context of these discussions. Remember, Freddie Mac was under huge investigations. They had multiple meetings about Freddie Mac at the exact same time. And that's what the council overlooks, is that this is a board of directors that was supposed to be on heightened alert because they were looking at Freddie Mac in the same business who had just paid them a $400 million fine to OFAO for their financial fraud, and it was in the exact same time period, the same months that this investigation was ongoing, that they received that Barnes memorandum and they accepted from the people in charge,
Council,
it's fine, just trust us.
We're well over time, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Barron, Ms. Mahoney, thank you very much. The case is submitted. Call the next case.